subject matter has not been entirely determined. In fact, from my point of view, it hasn't been determined at all. It will be determined by the calls from people like you. If you have a question about some topic related to Christianity or the Bible, or if you have a difference of opinion on a topic that has been discussed here by the host, and you'd like to raise those points, this is a good time to do it. We have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. Your call will determine the direction the program goes for a little while anyway. A part of the program that gives you such power, you know, to affect what thousands of people hear by making a call to this number, 1-800-438-5090. If we have listeners down in Orange County right now, I'll be speaking down there day after tomorrow, Saturday, in the afternoon from 4 to dinner time, and including a dinner in at a home, which has where I go about once a month. And it's open for our listeners. That's why we do it. If you're a listener down in the Orange County area or somewhere in Southern California, you want to drive into Lake Forest, which is like by Irvine, that's happening this Saturday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And there will be a meal at the end of it. If you'd like directions to that meeting, you can call Don or Jennifer at 949-855-7821. 7821. I'll give you that again. It's area code 949, and the number is 855-7821. You can also find that information at our website, so if you didn't get it just now, you can go to thenarrowpath.com and go to the announcements link, and you'll find that information. We have a line open for you still at 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to join us here. Our first caller today is going to be Jim, calling from Portland, Oregon. Jim, good to hear from you again.
Yes, God bless you, Steve. I love you, and I thank God for your ministry and your diligence and study. And my question that I have for you today is on the origin of evil. Now, we know that God, from all eternity, before he created angels or humans, has always been holy, righteous, etc., etc. We know that when he created Satan, actually Lucifer, he created him as a free moral agent, so to speak, an angel with volition. But my question is how is it that if God created everything and he didn't create evil, where did evil originate from? Like, for example, Adam and Eve, God created them innocent. He did leave them in the garden to test them, and told them, don't eat of the fruit, the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So my question is where would have evil originated from?
Okay. First of all, I would like to clarify my view that evil is not a thing. Evil is not something that was created.
Uh-huh.
Evil is simply a description of certain kinds of behaviors. And so the first person to commit an evil act was the first person to introduce evil into the creation. And that was Adam and Eve, of course, did that. And as far as how they did that, they did not do that by tapping into some existing phenomenon called evil. They did so by choosing to do what God told them not to do, and thus committing the first act that had evil as its quality, having an evil quality. Now, some would say that evil had originated with Lucifer's rebellion in heaven. And if the traditional view is correct, if Lucifer indeed was an angel and fell, which is not clearly taught in Scripture but is a strongly held tradition in the Church, if that is true, then apparently the first evil act was committed by the devil. There is another view, and it's based on some things that Jesus said, actually. For example, Jesus said that the devil was a murderer from the beginning, and in John 8:44, and over in 1 John 3:8, John says the devil sinned from the beginning. And it's not clear whether he means from his own beginning, that is, he's always been that way, or whether it means the beginning of something else. But there is a suggestion that God actually made the devil not as Lucifer, not as an angel. And by the way, it might seem surprising that anyone could suggest that, but if you actually look at the passages in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, mm-hmm. from which the traditional view is derived, If you look at them carefully, you'll find that there's not any clear statement that they are referring to the devil at all. One of them says it's talking to the king of Babylon, and the other one says it's talking to the king of Tyre.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally, Christian teachers have said this is also referring to the devil, but there's nothing in the passages that really say so. But the point is that the devil might have been a good guy at first who fell, which is the pretty universal tradition of the church, or he might have been created for the purpose of testing Adam and Eve. But if he was created as a tester, some people say, well, that means that God created evil. I wouldn't say that. I would say that God, if in that case, would have created the opportunity for people to do good or evil, and that they would do good was not a foregone conclusion. They were going to be tested about that, and God provided an examiner, a tester, someone to try to lead them to do the wrong thing if they would. Of course, they didn't have to, so this was just a test, and they failed the test. But their failure of the test would be the first introduction of human evil, and the, as far as where it came from, as near as I can tell, their own human ability to choose either to obey God or not. The fact that they were able to choose not to obey God does not mean that there was an element in them that was in itself evil, as if God had implanted evil in them and they just simply tapped into that.
Right.
But rather, they were simply capable of putting themselves first rather than God first, just like you and I can. And that's, you know, we don't really have an explanation of evil.
So it would be fair to say that God created the potential for them to choose evil, but he was not the author or the origin of it from the very beginning.
Well, yeah, there was not evil in the world, I believe, until Adam and Eve sinned. And their sin was the creation of evil by them.
Okay. Because when we go back to Isaiah 14, it seems as if Lucifer's sin was complete selfishness, the five I wills from verses 13
right.
through 14.
What I'm saying is that Lucifer there is never identified with the devil. You see, Lucifer is a term that's found only one time in Scripture. It's in Isaiah 14:12.
Uh-huh.
And that passage that mentions him does not say that he's the devil. But if you look back to verse 4 of the same chapter,
uh-huh.
It says, you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon.
Uh-huh.
The king of Babylon was a man, and the person who is called Lucifer appears to be a man also, because if you read what he said to Lucifer in verses 12 through 16,
uh-huh.
He says to Lucifer in verse 16, those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man
right.
who made the earth to tremble? So it would appear that the man, the king of Babylon, identified in verse 4, and called a man in verse 16 is the same one who's referred to as the morning star in verse 12, which is really the meaning of the word Lucifer.
Right, yeah. Do you think what Jesus said in Luke 10, where he said, I beheld Satan fall from heaven as a lightning, do you think that would correlate with what the description of Isaiah 14 is referring to as well?
Well, not necessarily. There are two views on that. One is that when Jesus said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven, in Luke chapter 10, that he was referring back to an original fall of Satan from having been an angel and then falling to become the devil. But many believe that when Jesus made that comment to those 70 who had just returned from an outreach where they'd been casting demons out, and they said to him, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said to them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. That Jesus was not making some kind of a cryptic reference to the origin of Satan, which, by the way, would not have an obvious connection to what they had just said. Some feel that what Jesus is saying is, you, my disciples, have seen individual people delivered from Satan's grip. You've seen demons go out of people in my name.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen something much greater going on. My vision is the immediate and rapid collapse of Satan entirely, his whole enterprise, not just a few people being delivered of demons, but I'm seeing in the cosmic sphere the collapse and the rapid destruction or fall of Satan, to which he could be referring to his, you know, what's going to happen when he dies, because when he died, the Bible says he destroyed him that had the it says in Hebrews 2:14, he destroyed him who had the power of the devil, the power of death, which is the devil, excuse me. So it's every verse that is used to talk about the origin of Satan in the traditional sense is a verse that can readily be understood differently than that. So we only have a few verses, and them ambiguous, that form the basis of our traditional understanding of the origin of Satan. As far as whether the traditional understanding is true or not is something that different people will have to decide differently on what they consider to be the strength of the evidence.
Yeah, because referring to the passage you had mentioned in Ezekiel, in verse 2, even though he's the Son of Man, which is Ezekiel, is speaking of the Prince of Tyre, in verse 13 he goes straight to the Garden of Eden and speaks of him in verse 14 as the anointed cherub. So do you think in that passage it is Ezekiel, even though he's rebuking the king of Tyre, he's actually at one point speaking directly about Satan himself? Just like, for example, when Jesus was casting out the demons and the two men of Gadara, mm-hmm. that he wasn't actually dealing with the man, he was dealing with the two men that were demon-possessed.
Yeah. Well, as far as those verses that talk about Eden in verse 13 and so forth of Ezekiel 28,
mm-hmm.
Okay, there's two ways that they could be taken. They could be taken either literally
mm-hmm.
or figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
And let's take them literally for the moment. Let's just, for the sake of argument, say what do we learn from them if we take them literally? It speaks to this king of Tyre. And it says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald, and gold. It says, the workmanship of your pipes and timbrels, or as modern translations say, your sockets and settings, was prepared in you on the day that you were created. Then it says in verse 14, you are the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in all your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. Then it says, by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within and you sinned.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God. Now, on one hand, it says he was in the garden of God.
Mm-hmm.
Then it says he was on the mountain of God.
Mm-hmm.
We don't read anywhere in Genesis that there was a mountain in the Garden of Eden. There could have been, I suppose, but it's not obvious that they are the same thing. And it says you were the anointed cherub that covered. Now, if we're taking this literally, we're saying, okay, who is this talking to? It's talking to somebody who was in the Garden of Eden, and they were a cherub. Okay, well, that's there were how many individuals do we know of were ever in the Garden of Eden? There was God, there was Adam and Eve, there was the serpent, and there was a cherub, the cherub that guarded the way to the tree of life.
Mm-hmm.
So if Ezekiel is speaking literally that the king of Tyre was the cherub in the Garden of Eden, then he was not the serpent, he was not Satan, he was this cherub that guarded the way to the tree of life. Because, of course, the serpent was never a cherub. And even if it was so, that Satan is a fallen angel, an angel and a cherub are not even the same thing. You know, Ezekiel, in the same book, earlier, in chapter 1, describes cherubs. They have four faces and four wings and so forth. One face like an ox, one like a lion, one like an eagle, one like a man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're strange-looking critters, and they're not your typical angels. They're not even archangels. They're something else. So, in my understanding, if we are to take Ezekiel's language about Eden and the cherub and the mountain of God and so forth literally, then we have to assume that he's addressing that cherub that was in the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
He's not addressing the devil. Now, another way to understand that is that the language is figurative, and that the person he's speaking to was not literally in the Garden of Eden, and was not literally a cherub, but he's using poetic language to speak about how privileged this person was and how important their position was until they became corrupted and fell. Now, in favor of that suggestion, I would just turn your attention to three chapters later to Ezekiel chapter 31.
Mm-hmm.
And verse 3, it says, indeed, Assyria was a cedar in Lebanon. Okay? Now, Assyria was not really a cedar tree.
Right.
And in fact, it was not really literally in Lebanon either. The cedars of Lebanon were famous for their height and so forth. And so he's using figurative language to talk about Assyria being a cedar in Lebanon. It's not literal. And then it says in verse 8, the cedars in the garden of God could not hide it. The fir trees were not like his boughs. And the chestnut trees were not like its branches. No tree in the garden of God was like it in beauty. I made it beautiful with a multitude of the branches so that all the trees of Eden envied it that were in the garden of God. Now, it sounds like he was a cedar in Lebanon. He was also a cedar in the garden of God, which is referred to as Eden in verse 9.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to my mind, this is all poetic language. I don't think the Assyrian was ever a real tree. And if he was, he was not a cedar in Lebanon. And if he was, he was not a cedar in the Garden of Eden. You know,
right.
There's a lot of fluidness to these metaphor or to these images. And the fact that Ezekiel talks about another king, not the king of Tyre, but the king of Assyria, or even the nation of Syria, of Assyria, as a tree in the Garden of Eden, and he speaks of the king of Tyre as a cherub in the Garden of Eden. I don't think that either of them is more likely to be literal than the other. I think that what Ezekiel is doing is using the Garden of Eden as an image of privileged, you know, place. Sort of like we'd say, well, I feel like I've died and gone to heaven.
Right.
Or, you know, I'm in paradise here in Hawaii or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's the poetic language of Ezekiel that throws us off. In Ezekiel chapter 28 there, where it does talk about the king of Tyre that way, it also says that he was corrupted by his trading, by the abundance of his trading,
mm-hmm.
in verse 16. Now that makes sense of the city of Tyre, because the city of Tyre was a port city. It was the most important port city on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. It was one of the wealthiest cities because of its commerce. And so to say of the king of Tyre that you became wealthy and corrupted because of the abundance of your trading makes sense if it's talking to the king of Tyre. It doesn't make as much sense if it was talking to the devil. And as I say, if it was talking to the devil, then the devil must not only have been the serpent in the garden, he must also have been the cherub in the garden, because that's who this king of Tyre is said to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying that these two passages, you know, Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, are not necessarily best understood as being about the devil, and there's nothing in them that specifically identifies Satan as the person being addressed.
Okay, so back to the original question of the origin of the evil. So it would be, to answer that question specifically, could I say that God did not create evil as one of his particular attributes, but he allowed the potential for it to come because he made humans volitional? He had to make the choice in order for them to be free moral agents. Do you think that would be accurate? That
would be my understanding of it, yeah. I don't even know that I've even talked about the issue of God creating or not creating evil, since I don't think evil is a created thing.
Okay.
You know, evil is a quality of certain
right.
actions. It's not a created thing. And the actions are decided by the actors. And the quality of their actions is their responsibility.
I see. Okay, well, again, thank you for your time, Steve. I love you. God bless you, and I'm continue to pray for your ministry.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your calls.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Yeah, have a good day. Bye-bye now.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to talk next to Mike from Houston, Texas. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I got a question. I was trying to catch you up through email, but you've been busy, so I'm going to catch you on the show. On those making atonement in captivity when the temple wasn't there, how did they atone for sins like Ezra or Daniel?
Well, they didn't have the ritual of the Day of Atonement while they were in Babylon. They didn't have the sacrifices. There was no temple to enter. And so they just had to do without it. But we need to understand that it says in Hebrews that it was impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin anyway. The rituals of the temple and the Day of Atonement and so forth did not literally take away sin. It was God who takes away sin, and it's because of the faith of the people. And so if the people are trusting in God, repentant, and so forth, I believe that they are personally right with God. Though I think the Day of Atonement and the sacrifice is there. What it was accomplishing is not the salvation of the individual Jews, but I think it was giving them an opportunity to cover their national transgressions for another year to avoid the kind of judgments that would ordinarily come upon their nation if their sins were not forgiven. And so there's two levels here in the Old Testament of forgiveness. One would be individual forgiveness of sins, which is always based on faith. Abraham believed God, and that was counted to him for righteousness. And so individual salvation and justification never was brought about by the blood of bulls and goats anyway. It was always by faith before